I'd like you to please help me welcome Johnny Cordero from Santa Barbara as our speaker tonight.
Good evening, everybody. My name is John Cordero, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Lee for asking me to come. There's not really a bigger honor in Alcoholics Anonymous as one of your peers asks you to participate. And I say that because Lee and I have been kind of trudging this road together for quite a while. And so obviously I've done something that's an attraction to Lee and vice versa. There's some people that I've gone on this road with, and I don't want a damn thing to do with them. And Lee and I had a little texting little thing back and forth, and you know, it's just good. There's no bigger honor than to be asked by your friend. And trust me, there's no bigger honor than to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people coming here will mouth it that it's an honor and a privilege. And I just can really consider it an honor because it kind of slights what our forefathers did, because they requested the privilege of carrying their message. They actually went out and beat the streets so they can carry this wonderful thing that they found when Bob visited Bill. They went out and solicited this golden message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get a phone call, I get a set of date, I get a couple of reminders to come up here, and that's no privilege. It's an honor. I'd like to thank my friend Scott and B for driving us up here, the Slasher, and especially my wife for coming. That's that front row right there. You figure it out, and the wonderful thing about like traveling to go different places is that you get the meeting before the meeting. You know, you get to chit chat and have those cup of coffee, and you relate on that basic human thing. You know, that thing that was in that kitchen. That thing when Abby visits Bill and it was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, and something started there. And we're blessed for that union because we're here in the year 2018 celebrating sobriety. I mean, I know what I'm supposed to do up here. It's not my first time at this rodeo, and I'll tell you my story. I was born the only child of my mom's second marriage when I was a little kid. My half-brothers and half-sisters would throw me out on the front porch and tell me that my real folks were going to come get me. That used to hurt my feelings. Made me feel not part of. And we were really poor. You know, we grew up on the Lower East Side of Santa Barbara. It's kind of silly thing to say, but there is one. And you know, we grew up in a third world poverty. You know, my mom, my mom was kind of jazzy. I have four siblings, and only two of them have the same father. And my mom raised five kids with any help from those deadbeat dads. And my mom, grew a victory garden in the backyard so we could have fresh vegetables, and I hated her for that. I just hated her for that, and I can remember just screaming, how come we can't have canned vegetables like everybody else? And now we spend a lot of money to buy organic vegetables at Costco. So I tell you that just so you know that my thinking was way worse than my drinking. You know, I grew up on that Lower East Side, and I grew up and I was really sensitive. I was a sensitive little boy. I can remember I was watching an old Western called Shane. And in this movie, this boy falls in love with this gunslinger, and this gunslinger does his deal, and he's mortally wounded at the end of the movie, and he saved the town, and he's riding away, and the boy has had harsh words with his hero. But he realizes his love for him, and he begins chasing him over the field, jumping over the fences, screaming his name, Shane, Shane, come back, Shane. I'm watching this as a little kid, and I am moved. I'm crying, Shane, come on. And my older half-brother, my hero, he came and he slapped me on the back of the head. And he said, you're sitting here in the middle of the day crying at a TV set. What's wrong with you? Boom. I start pushing him down. Boom. Boom. I had to go to work with my mom. During the day, she worked at a woman's clothing store, and I have this thing for black nylon stockings. I have it today, but I control and enjoy it. And so, you know, if you go to a woman's clothing store and you sit in the middle of the rack, you know how you ladies do. You go around like that. I'd plant myself there first thing in the morning and I would wait. And surely, you know, I don't know what time of the day, but some lady would come by with black nylon stockings and I just couldn't control myself and I'd reach my little paw out there and rub her leg a little bit. And the lady would scream, ah, my mom would come and grab me. Her favorite pet name for me was little son of a bitch. Come here, little son. And because of that little defective character, my mother enrolled me in a reading program at the Santa Barbara Public Library. And reading really became my first escape. I can remember I read my whole life, and I've always read fantasy books. I always wanted to be transported from where I was, because my life always seemed like it punctured my John suit. My life was just really tough for me. And I always read fantasy books. And, you know, initially when I read fantasy books, I was always a hero. I was the elven lord. I was the one that saved the village. And then sometimes as I got older, I said, in the middle of my alcoholism, I kind of got a little honest with myself. I said, you know what, you're not the elven lord. You're the dark lord. And then at the end of my drinking, I got really honest with myself. And I wasn't even that. I was Gollum. I was a cat that slithered out of the mud and stole from you and slithered right back in. I can't tell you when I started drinking. I grew up in a neighborhood where poverty was there. I grew up with a lot of blacks, Mexicans, and some white trash. Kind of like this room. A lot like this room, kind of think about it. And our common bond was poverty. You know, we stole from the rich people and kept it, you know. And I don't know when I started drinking. They didn't ask me to write an essay when I was in first grade. When are you going to start drinking, John? And it just happened. It was all around. I can tell you when something significant happened for me, and that's when I was in seventh grade. When I was in seventh grade, I was drinking and smoking headache weed. And I don't know if you know what that is, but I'll explain it to you. You jump into Lee's backyard. You steal his plant. Well, not the plants are growing now. That shit would kill. I mean, that stuff would kill me. But you jump into steal Lee's plant. You go home. You throw it in the bottom of the oven. It gets dry. You roll a big old fatty, and you smoke it, and you get a headache. And I was doing that with my oldest brother, the one that hit me. And I was doing that with my friends. And my oldest brother was trying to make an amends to me, I think. And he gave me, at that time, it was called a four-finger bag of Redbud Columbia. And I rolled that up and I took it to seventh grade. And everybody wanted what I had and they were willing to go to any length to get it. And I tell you that story only because this feeling of inferiority, this feeling of being less than, this feeling of not being part of haunted me. It consumed my whole life of not being part of this earth. And I thought if I was not holding, that you would not be my friend. I thought that if I wasn't packing, that you wouldn't invite me anywhere. I said that one time at a meeting when I was 7 years sober and my best friend had gotten sober some 7 years after me. And he told me, he goes, you know what, Johnny boy? He goes, you are the ringleader. So what I offer to you is the illness of alcoholism is an illness of perception. I could not perceive my life as it was really going on because I always looked at it through the veil of my alcoholism. And I always looked at it with my sick vision. So I couldn't really tell you what my world was about, truthfully, because I just saw it through my illness. When I was a junior in high school, my mother got really sick. And she had to have an emergency hysterectomy, and she got hospitalized. And when she was in the hospital, a welfare came to her to offer some assistance. And, you know, they told us, they said, hey, Carmen, there's help for people like you. You know, you don't have to shoulder this burden all. There's help. And we want to give some, we want to give you some help. And my mom ratted me out. She said, my youngest, he doesn't come home at night. He brings people over I'm afraid of. He's verbally and physically abusive to me. And welfare wanted to bestow some benefits on my mom, but they wanted to talk to me. And I didn't want to talk to them. But I have two older half-brothers, and they beat the crap out of me, and they delivered me at my first counselor. First. I had a lot of them. And when you're ready for a counselor, it's a great thing. But when you're not ready, it's not. And I went to this gal, and she was cute. Right out of college, little ruffled blouse, little skirt. And she asked me something really lame. You know when somebody's lame and asks you something, you know, like you can just tell they're lame. You gotta go, ooh, jeez, man, you know. I think she asked me how I felt when I smoked a marijuana cigarette. I looked at her and went, oh my God. And at that particular time in my life, if you weren't in my crew and I didn't trust you, I would go after you in a bunch of different ways. If I thought I could attack you verbally, I would, or intellectually, I would. If there was something laying around and I thought I could whack you with it and beat the crap out of you, I'd do that too. And I just went after her. I said, have you ever maintained a 3.86 grade point average in college prep courses? I don't think so. I said, this is just a phase I'm going through. You can't imagine what my life's going to be like. I'm going to be the Saturday night speaker in Oregon in the year 2018. And she bought it. She bought it. She went back to my mom and said, you know what? He's excelling at school. And I tell you that story because that lady, she never had a chance with me. She never had a chance of penetrating me because once I ascertained that you were a lame, it just went up. Whoosh, boom, and you're not getting in. You are not, you don't have a chance. And the thing that sets Alcoholics Anonymous apart is that it's always one alcoholic talking to another. Until that thing, until you trust me or I trust you, nothing happens here. Nothing happens here. It's that process of identification, and there was none. The other thing that was to come out of that is I had to go work for the neighborhood youth corps. And they threw me up in the Los Padres National Forest in, you know, 100 degree weather with a hand tool, and man, it just fit me like a glove. I liked everything about it. I liked the dirt. I liked the heat. And as a result of that, when I graduated high school in 1975, they hired me to fight wildland fires for the Forest Service on a hotshot crew. When you're on a hotshot crew, they put about 35 pounds of gear around your waist, they give you a hand tool, and they put you on a mountain like that in extreme conditions, and they tell you to go after it. I'm 18 years old, and everything, anytime something's not going right in my world, anytime I'm rejected, anytime somebody says no, anytime something doesn't go Johnny Boy's way, which is all the time, I just get tighter and tighter and tighter, and I walk around, and you could have popped a quarter off any part of my body. I was so tense. And they gave me this hand tool, and it came out. I just started slamming the ground like, you son of... And I would just go for hours on hate. Just hours on hate. And I would go up to the biggest guy in the crew and tell him to grab a tool. And he'd be a normal human being. It'd be 100 degrees. He'd go to go drink water and say, pick up your tool, you pussy. Let's go. And when you're an idiot like that, the Forest Service loves you. They think you're a hard worker. They have no idea you're a crazed alcoholic. You know, and I did wow there. I did wow there in the mid-70s. And some of you guys there, it was the Equal Rights Amendment. And they were trying to, at that particular time, and especially in fire suppression, they were trying to get blacks, Mexicans, and women in fire. And I was the golden boy. But my alcoholism was catching up to me much faster than I was coming up behind Smokey the Bear. And I was having terrible problems with control. Terrible problems. I can remember I'd be in my Forest Service greens, and I'd have some skull between my cheek and gum, and I'd be at Cold Springs Tavern, and they play country western music there, and I'd put aside a couple of quarters in the jukebox, and I'd start singing cowboy songs. I'm gonna look in Bach, Texas, Waylon Willie and the boys. The success, and I'd be holding that long neck bud, and I'd be going, man, if I knock this back, all hell's gonna break loose. And I'd get in my car and had automatic pilot and make it down 154 by itself. All of a sudden, boom, like I'd be in Santa Barbara. And then the disco craze was going on. And when that much cocaine was running too. And I'd do that, and I had this really badass polyester suit. I had this simulated silk shirt. And I had this really cool gold chain, but it made my neck green. And and I had some platforms on, and I'd be at the discotheque moving around. And I'd have something cute in my hand, like a Greyhound. Perfect. My finger was out perfect. And I'd be slamming back that thing at Pepper's. I only saw Scott at Pepper's once or twice. And same thing would happen at Pepper's. I'd go, oh, man. Oh, man. And I'd get in my car, and it'd slither its way back to the Lower East Side. It slithered back to a beer bar called George's Poorhouse. And they serve you beer in a pitcher, and you can get a glass, but that's kind of like an option. Because you buy a pitcher with whatever change you got in your pocket. It's that kind of beer. And on that beer, overweight ladies in bikinis serve you there. It's called George's Poorhouse. And over the top of that bar, it says, the more you drink, the better they look. Now, I saw Jason there a lot, but that wasn't something I did once or twice, man. I was phony as a $3 bill. If you let me into a room and you give me 5 minutes, I will change into anything that's going on in that room to get what I want. Orderly Holmes, what's going on? Oh, dude, did you see El Capo's overhead, you know? Anything. Just give me a minute. Just give me a minute. You know, during this time, I got my high school sweetheart pregnant, and we had our first child. And we had a party after at our house for the child when she was still in the hospital, and the party went on so long that I never made it back to pick her up from the hospital. And I remember coming home, she goes, we can't afford for me to spend another day in there. I just couldn't get myself to the hospital. And then 2 years later, we were to have another child at home with a midwife. And I wish I could tell you about that. I really wish I could tell you about that. But the selfishness and self-centeredness that's the root of our illness is on me, and I don't have any time to be there for a kid. I got something to do, and it ain't that. You know, and I can look at you guys, and I can look at most communities, and most communities, having children is the lifeblood of all communities. Children are celebrated when they come into our lives, and I have my own blood, and I'm rejecting it. And I'm not rejecting this child because of the child itself. I'm rejecting this child because I don't want any responsibility. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it, and I don't want to hear it from nobody. My sponsor, Ray, says he doesn't wish the last 3 years of his drinking on anybody, and after the birth of my daughter, Regina, I don't wish my last 3 years of drinking on anybody, because on her birth, there was no doubt in my mind, I knew who I was. I could not look at myself in the mirror and not know what I had become. And no matter how much drinking I did, or any of the other stuff that we do, I just couldn't seem to put it down. I just couldn't seem to stuff it out. And I lived in that terrible, terrible thing called alcoholism. When you come to and it's gray, and you don't know if it's gray in the morning or gray in the evening. And your head spins around with chaos. Your heart thumps out of your chest. And you're just trying to put together fragments of time. What kind of chaos and mayhem did I create now? And you have that tightening in your jaw and that feeling like, oh man, it's coming up. And always constantly in your temples. Boom, 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 boom. And I'm going to feel that until I find my drink. During coming to one time like that, my first wife caught me coming to. And she loved me for some reason. She loved me for some reason. And she wanted to know what happened. Where was this golden boy at? And she was crying and just pounding on my chest, going, John, John, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? And for a brief moment, you know, I wanted to tell her, I don't even know what day it is. I have no idea how much money I spent. I am really sick. But by that time, I'm an animal. And you never, ever corner an animal, especially not a wild one. And I leapt off that bed and I threw her on the ground and I started throttling her. And I said, don't you ever, ever ask me what I've been doing or how I'm doing or I'll kill you. And that wasn't the first time I laid my hands on that lady, but that was the last, because she asked me to leave. And I didn't want to leave because we rented a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house from her mother for nothing a month. And that's good rent when you're drinking the way I am. A couple of weeks later, I went back to her and I made that solemn oath that we make in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back and I begged her and I was crying, and I believe at that time the tears were sincere. I was crying or begging her back, telling her, hey, I'm going to be that man, that provider, that lover, that husband. I'm going to be everything. And I'm going to make it all up to you. And this was President's Day weekend in 1984. And I said, we're going to go skiing in Mammoth, and we get back, we're going to come back, and it's going to be a new life. And she agreed to go. And on the end of our first day, when we were sitting there, she said, John, this is really nice, but when we come home, you're still going to have to leave. Our book says we will not be able to call with sufficient force the pain, suffering, humiliation of a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink, and I was. And I started drinking. And I went into a blackout. And I started some chaos and mayhem in Mammoth Lakes, California. And I ended up on somewhere on the Mammoth Loop. I had rolled my vehicle in the middle of a snowstorm. And somehow I had managed to crawl out of that vehicle, drop my keys in the snow, which is an important part because they couldn't convict me of driving drunk. And I got a sleeping bag that I'd stolen from the Forest Service, and I put a rubber mat on the snow and survived. And I was found the next morning by the Highway Patrol and told something that at least half of you in this room have heard before, that you're lucky to be alive. And I didn't feel so lucky. I really didn't feel so lucky because I had done it again. I had built up the hopes and aspirations of everybody around me, and I had this uncanny ability just to smash it. You know, I often forget to talk about my ex-wife, who's one of my best friends now, Anna, that day. And that night, what I put her through. Because that night, I put this lady in something, in a predicament that you would never, ever want to put anybody who you would call your friend in. And that was this. initially, she's calling around going, I hope they find him. I hope he's okay. And on her next breath, she'd go, I hope that little son of a... She's dead. Because she was tired of the abuse. And she'd go, oh my God, what am I thinking? I hope they find him. She goes, no, he's just better off if he's gone. I hope they find... That's what she did all night. You know, if nobody ever asks a chick, you know, challenge our humanity again like that because of my stupid actions, I'm overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our cry is, I'm not hurting anybody. No, I'm killing you. I'm ripping your soul out from your throat. And yet my cry is, leave me alone. I'm not hurting you. A couple weeks later, I'm at my good brother's house drinking a fifth of tequila. Do they have a fifth anymore? Or do they have quarts? Do they? It's been a long time. Anyways, I'm drinking a fifth of tequila, and Anna comes over and she says, there's another reason why I asked you to leave is I'm in love with your best friend. That hurt my feelings. You know, but I told you where I come from. And there's a code. And I slammed a little more at tequila and I jumped on a train going back to the east side of Santa Barbara because I'm gonna visit Eloy. And I have a baseball bat in my hand. And when I jumped on the train on the west side, it kind of had just started up. By the time I got to Milpa Street, it was hauling ass and I couldn't quite figure out which way to jump. So I went the butt way and I landed on the railroad tracks, broke my navicular bone in his wrist and got a charley horse over my ass, and I'm walking around like this, and I'm not kicking Eloy's ass today. So I hailed down a taxi and I went to Merlot's Liquor and went on a 4 or 5 day bender. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous right around that time. My sobriety date that I claim is April 4th of 1984. I think I was sober before, but my first sponsor was really mean. He goes, you're a liar. And so he said, we're going to add a couple more days just because you lie. And I go, ooh. Yeah, my first sponsor was, I don't think he liked me. He was a really big man. He was 6'4", 230 pounds. He played ball for the Dodgers. And I asked him, and he's a really handsome man, I asked him to be my sponsor because he had all the women and I wanted what he had. And, I just wanted the leftover shit, you know. You know, I used to go to this 5:30 meeting. They had just started it when I got sober. And I was going, you know, when you're new, you're a really good member. I showed up at 5:30. And I left at 6:30, and I didn't talk to anybody. It's anonymous, remember? Alcohol Anonymous. And so I went there, and I've been going there for about a month, and this guy who he started a lot of stuff in Santa Barbara. He started a convention there, some of the meetings there, Bill Bedard. And he played a con on me and Tim and a few other people, and the con plays on egotistical men. So he'd been seeing me there, going there for about a month, and this is the con. He goes, hey, look, I seen you been coming around here for 30 days. How would you like to make coffee for this group? I told him, no. I'm not making coffee for a room full of crackers. And I was in a cast because of my train incident, and he pinched me on the neck, and he was walking around the corner. As you could tell, I have a big mouth. I've had my ass kicked a few times. So I go, here we go. And he laid the con. He goes, hey, slick, I wouldn't ask you to make coffee for this group, but if you don't make coffee for this group, this meeting will probably end. If this meeting ends, the Alano Club will probably close. If the Alano Club closes, AA and Santa Barbara will probably cease to exist. No shit. guess I can help you cats out then, you know? And and what happened is that guy, I'll be forever grateful for Bill because he put one of those parts of the triangle together for me. Unity, service, and recovery. And I'll tell you, for a tough guy, there's no better thing than service. And I'll tell you why. Because I felt so odd in my body. I felt so odd being in a room like this that when I was making the coffee and you could smoke in meetings there and putting out the ashtrays and arranging the seats, I felt this much more comfortable. And when I felt that much more comfortable, I was capable of hearing the language of the heart. That's all service did for me. It made me feel comfortable in a room that was going to eventually save my life. We used to do this thing in Santa Barbara called wining and dining. Lee does it. That's when you go out to have dinner with your sponsor, and you wine while they dine. Todd's almost a pro at it now, and so one day, I don't know what. To this day, I don't even know, and I. Joe doesn't even know what was going on that one day. But one day, and I'm new in sobriety, we're going to go eat at Jolly Tigers. And I got something to whine about. And we haven't even sat down yet. And I'm whining about whatever it was. Probably somebody didn't call me to share at the 5:30 meeting or something really important like that. And I go to slither into the booth and I sit down and Joe's had it. Joe's had it. And he gets this white napkin and he rises to his full 6'4 height and he just throws this napkin down and he gets in my, his eyes are like popping out and he's spitting when he's talking at me and he's saying a bunch of words that end in ing and sound like trucking and basically he tells me, hey, if I'm not going to take responsibility for my sobriety, I might as well take my trucking out of AA. He lays into me in a public place. Now, I'm new, and I know he's violated every tradition now. And I tell you, I like to read, so I'm going to report him to New York. Because at the Alano Club meeting, I've heard you're supposed to love the newcomer, and this ain't love. I'm pretty much aware of that, you know, And what came out of my mouth was, forget you, Joe. And we were off and running. And Joe slammed me into the book. He just slammed me into the book. And during this time, in my early sobriety, my dad's dying. My dad's dying because he's had two leg amputations. And during the second leg amputation, he gets AIDS. From the blood transfusions, they weren't hip to it. And one of the things about going through the steps quickly is that I'm on the amend steps with my father already. And I'm at the hospital with him every day. He said he didn't like the Dodgers, but they were always on TV. I fed him Jell-O. I helped the nurses flip him so he wouldn't get bed sores. And I have to tell you the story because my father knew who I was. And my father, during my run, my 13-year run, my dad would not allow me in his house after 5 p.m. If I got there before 5, my dad would feed me. He'd give me a clean pair of underwear and some socks and give me 2 bits. I can get a donut and a coffee the next morning. If I came there after 5, wouldn't let me in. I tested that one time in the winter during Monday Night Football. I wasn't even drinking. I just had beer. And I was drinking one, and I got there at 5:15. I said, drink a six-pack of Dad's, and went about 5:15, and I, Dad, it's me. TV went up. Dad, it's me. Door latched. Dad, you close all the drapes. Slept in the park that night. Working with Joe, when I was 4.5 months sober, my father made me the executor of his estate. And I tell you that because Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works really good. And as soon as you're ready to put in the effort, the sooner you'll get the results. You know, I've heard it said a number of times this way in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, if the cure for cancer was contained in 12 steps and we all had cancer, there'd be a mad rush to the door. And yet we have this insidious disease, illness called alcoholism, and somebody who wants to help you and give you a spiritual remedy for it says, hey, look, we need to take these steps. And we just kind of go, slow down there, book thumper. And the thing about it is, I'll prove to you that you want to take the steps. I'll prove it to you right now. How many of you went to a bar and they poured you a drink? And it's a good bartender too. And you take a hit of that. How many of you slid that back and said, hey, can you water that down for me? I didn't think so. And yet when somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous gives you a strong solution, how come you want to water it down? If you like the effect that was produced by that double, you're going to love the effects produced by the 12. You know, and I started in on Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, wow. I thought I was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous in Santa Barbara. You know that guy, all teeth. I have my nose so far up old timer's ass, it's brown. I still can't get it off, you know what I mean? You know, a guy like Lee would go like this and have his chair put away from him. You know, that guy. And, you know, I'm on every single committee there is. You know, I'm the cookie girl. I'm on everything. You know, I'm doing everything. I'm president of the board of the Alano Club. I'm doing everything. And I'll tell you that because what I did is I got involved in the activities of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I ceased taking the actions. And they're two distinct things. And so what happened is I'm 4.5 years sober, and I'm remarried, and I'm at home, and something's not going Johnny Boy's way again. And I have not been inventorying. I have not been working with others. And I kick a glass table. Boom! And it shatters. And no words are spoken, and it's time for me to leave. It's time for me to leave. And I think what happens after that is maybe the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had this thought. And I knew where the answer was, and I went back to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and started taking a blue-collar approach to it. And I can remember during that time I wrote an inventory, and I just couldn't write it fast enough. I was getting so much relief. You know, but my second wife was a beautiful woman, and I'm just still drove by jealousy, and we used to live below this hill, and I know that when I'm out trying to get well, Sancho's going over there. You know how you guys are and you gals, you know, Sancho's. And so I'm going to my meetings, I'm doing my stuff, and then I'm going over there in the middle of the night and watching that front door, making sure nobody's coming and going, and it's the winter time. I used to smoke then. And I'm freezing my ass off watching the front door. So about, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd be sure nothing's going to go on there, and I'd go back home, or where I was staying at, what couch I was surfing on that day. After about 4 or 5 days of that crap, I became entirely ready to have God remove that defect of character. And I'll tell you that little story because I was 4.5 years sober. And I guess for 32 and a half years, domestic violence has not been a part of my life. Alcoholics Anonymous works. and it works really, really good. After that little incident, I was no longer phony as a $3 bill. To thine own self be true. And this guy named Matt moved up to Santa Barbara, and we started clowning him. Because he said he had this action group in LA, West LA, and he called them the MOAs, the Men of Action. So we clowned him, we stole his name and called ourselves the MOA, and we started meeting in my garage every Monday. And we started going through the big book line by line, and anytime it said to do an action, we would stop as a group and take that action, and we wouldn't move until everybody did it. So it says, write a list of your resentments. We'd hand out paper. And at the time, in its heyday, there's probably maybe 30 guys in there, and they'd all start writing. And then we'd go back next week, and when time went up, we'd go back next week. Everybody finished their writing, and you know, it only happened twice that somebody didn't do something we did, and we just said, okay, well, we can drink the coffee, but we ain't moving until everybody's moved on. And the great thing about that in Santa Barbara right now, there's a bunch of guys celebrating, 27, 28, 25 years. You know, I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in when I was 26 years old, and next month I'll be 61. You know, and I've grown up in a number of ways. You know, I think that Alcoholics Anonymous is going back to its roots, I hope. You know, I think when I got sober in the mid-80s, it was a lot of sage and crystals. And then I think, we got heavily influenced, and I think we went really hard into an academic version of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe there was a old-timer that I used to say they're the Bills and the Bobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would say from my own experience that I've been Bill and Bob. But I think I'm best served when I'm both. Because the remedy for alcoholism has always been spiritual in nature. It's not an academic process. The process is to enable us to grow spiritually and to continue to grow spiritually. And you know, I had an experience 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I was struck down, my appendix burst. And had not been for Liz, I would have died. Because I was too vain to go to the hospital. I just kept thinking I had the bad flu. That's why I was spinning around the floor like a top. I had the bad flu. And she told me, get in my truck or I'm calling an ambulance. And I'm too vain to go in an ambulance. So I got in her truck. But my appendix burst. And then on the second or third day, it was getting close to me to die. It was getting close. My world had gotten super small at that particular time. It became one breath in and one breath out. And at a certain point, I just gave up. I was ready to go. My side of the street was clean. I had nothing to fear. But I also, when I came out, obviously I didn't die. But during those moments after that intense time, you know, I didn't really think about my precisely squared four-column inventory. I thought about what my friend Sharon Crane talked about when her loved Casey died. That it's all about love and service. Bob says that in his last address to us. I'm paraphrasing, but he says what it all boils down to is we all know what love is and we all know what service is. And I believe that in Alcoholics Anonymous that we learn from people's stories. I learned so much from people's stories, and you wouldn't even imagine what things resonate when you just tell your own story to somebody else. Leah just reminded me that he says he's a Jew Buddha Christian. And for somehow, that elicits something in me. It inspires something inside of my mind to seek something spiritual for some reason. And it's just a story. And I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, we learn from listening to other people's story. That's the community here. That's the love we have here. You know, we're really blessed in this thing. We're really blessed in the fact that, you know, we can come together and battle this deadly illness called alcoholism through telling stories. But at the same time, we have to, you know, I'm really glad that we have it written down. I'm really glad that we have a common solution. That I know that you guys are going to do it like you guys. And Santa Maria is going to do it like Santa Barbara. Maybe not exactly the same, but we're going to get the end result. Does it really matter how precise we are we do it if we get the end result, which is a relationship with a power much greater than ourselves that enables us not to take that first drink and to find a life, a useful life? You know, I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us the tools to become powerful spiritual warriors. Because we go to battle every day, man. It's 2018. Take a look out there. We better have our armor on. Better continue to take inventory. Better work with others. Better seek through prayer and meditation. And I don't say this better for you, better for me. Because there's nothing more powerful than the example. You know, when I got sober in 1984, there was a lot of big, giant personalities, and they would come up to podiums like this, and they'd come in a room like this, and they would go, "When I come back here next year, half of you will be dead and drunk." And that's not the message I want to carry in the year 2018. It says experience, strength, and hope, right? In this room right now, there's more time in this room than when they wrote the big book. Experiential. We have experience here. And the strength of this room. Think about this. In our heyday, all of us in our heyday right now, if we went over to that little shopping center over here where we got coffee at, we'd make national news. They go, "Oh shit, there's a riot." So we have the strength. The most important thing is hope. We are the last house on the block. We do not shoot our wounded. And we forever have to be the place where hope abounds. We always have to be the place when somebody who's dying spiritually because alcoholism has them in their grip, we always have to provide a home for them to come to. We have to be the bastions of hope for all of them, for our brothers who are still suffering. Think about it. Experience strength and hope. I'm going to tell you two stories. I'm going to get down a little early. Because I like telling stories. And the first story is about my daughter, Regina, the one that I rejected at birth. 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago, I get a call from Regina. And she'd heard me talk, and we fell out. But, you know, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're tight. And she calls me 6.5 years ago, and she had had two kids already and was wanting to get back in the workforce. And she called me and she goes, "Dad, and we have a miracle baby because she got pregnant on the pill." And she goes, "Dad, I got pregnant on the pill. And I'm not sure I want this child. And I didn't have anybody in the world to talk to about it but you." Now, I thought my experience might help some knucklehead, and I didn't have any idea it was going to be my own daughter. And we talked a lot of that night about it, and, you know, she had Alyssa, and Alyssa's a great little kid, and my daughter Regina's a great mom. about 2.5 years ago, Regina came to work for me. And she manages my little pest control company. And I had a reminder about when she was at work for about 2 weeks that I'm still the boss and I signed your check still. And we have this wonderful relationship. The second story I'd like to tell you is about my mom. That lady who I terrorized, who I beat up and pushed around. And my mom's 96 now. She's never been over 5 feet and probably never weighed over 100 pounds. And when she comes to Santa Barbara, she likes to stay with me and Liz because she says, it's calm there. The truth is she likes to come over because my brothers and sisters make her eat like a good diet. And my mom likes Rocky Road ice cream and she can have that morning, noon, and night when she's with me. She's 96.
Right.
I'll give you 2 scoops. So one time, my mom comes to visit my sister and Lori, because Lori has been battling cancer, and Lori had just got out of the hospital, and she's at home in her robe. And my mom comes, it's summertime, and she's wearing sandals, and her toenails are hanging over the sandals like the raptors in Jurassic World. And I come over to visit, I'm kind of horrified. I'm kind of go, whoa. I'm thinking to myself, my sister, I'm going, Lori, don't be so selfish, man. Cut mom's toenails, you know. And so my mom comes home with me that night. Liz takes off to go do something, and I'm sitting at home. And I've heard this story, Larry Thomas. You guys ever heard of Larry Thomas? He tells this wonderful story about rubbing his mom's feet. So I go, Mom, would you like me to cut your toenails? She gets a big ass grin. She goes, oh, John, would you? And I'm horrified. I go, oh. Because I hate old people's feet. And I'm walking to the bathroom to get the toenail clippers, and I'm going, I hate Larry Thomas, man. And and I come back, and I got the big ones. Boom, I'm snapping those things off, and they're flying around like shrapnel. And my dog and cat are going, like that, you know? And then, and on the second to the last toe, I cut her. And I don't have any Band-Aids. So I east-side it up. I got some toilet paper and some masking tape. Boom! Put a little bit of lotion on them bad boys and... And I'll tell you that story because what happened there was a period of time, about 10 minutes, when me and my mom were doing that. When me and my mom had that interchange, and it was kind of like that movie where Neo stops the bullet and he looks at it. And I'm sure if you stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, you've had this moment where you've been able to sit back and look at your life and kind of go, Jesus, I came a long ways from there to there. And I had told my mom that I had loved her and was sorry for everything I did. And more importantly, I had showed her at that particular time, it had been like 31 years. I had shown her this new way of life, this new way of thinking and living. And I had been a living example of an amend to my mother. Those are the two most horrid things I did in my drinking. Abused my mother and rejected my child. It says in our literature, no matter how far down the scale you have gone, you will find peace. Peace be with all you.